Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining our virtual community and supporting our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
We are beginning the letter to Pergamum, in which we have this cryptic statement. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, yet you hold fast my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. So that's going to be the main verse we're looking at. But if you want to follow along, I'll read the whole passage so we get it in its context. Revelation chapter 2, verses 12 through 17, the epistle to Pergamum. It says, and to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, the words of him who has the sharp, two-edged sword. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, yet you hold fast my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel so that they might eat food, sacrifice to idols, and practice sexual immorality. So also you have some who hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Therefore, repent. If not, I will come to you soon and war against them with the sword of my mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give a white stone. All right, so I saw five interesting topics here. There might be more, but there are five things that caught my attention. There's the sharp sword, the one with the sharp sword, right? There's Satan's throne, where Satan dwells in Pergamum. What's that about, right? There's Antipas, my faithful witness. Who's this guy? Where did he come from? There's the white stone, very cryptic, and the hidden manna, which no one can find. All right, so these are the five things. I figure that we probably didn't have time to address all five of these tonight, but we'll try to get through 1, 2, and 3 and save the white stone and the hidden manna maybe for next week, although it would have been really nice to be able to get the white stone and the hidden manna in this week because they pertain to this week's Torah portion. Next week will be just... Let's start with this sharp sword. We'll start with this sharp sword. It says, the words of him who has the sharp two-edged sword. The sharp two-edged sword. What is this sharp two-edged sword? Well, as we learn, each one of these epistles to the seven assemblies begins with a reference. The master makes a reference back to the original vision that John beheld of the angel of Yeshua on the island of Patmos back in the first chapter of Revelation, where it said, in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white like wool, like snow, his eyes like a flame of fire, his feet like burnished bronze, refined in the furnace, his voice like the roar of many waters, and in his right hand, seven stars. And from his mouth came, and here it is, a sharp, two-edged sword. And his face was like the sun shining in full strength. Delitzsch translates that sharp, two-edged sword, how do you say that in Hebrew? Cherev pipiot, which would mean a sword with two mouths. Because the Hebrew scriptures, it's the mouth of the sword, that's how, the idiom for, you know, an edge of a sword, that's the mouth of the sword in Hebrew. So pipiot is two mouths, double-mouthed, the double-mouthed sword. So what is this double-edged sword, this cherev pipiot? I believe this refers back, first of all, to a prophecy of King Messiah that we receive from the book of Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 11, 4, where it says regarding King Messiah, with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. So here we have a weapon, a weapon that's connected with the mouth of King Messiah. So it's the rod of his mouth is the is a way of saying the authority and the power of the word that comes forth from the lips of King Messiah. He speaks with authority and power, the rod of his mouth. And then it goes on and says, and with the breath of his lips, he shall kill the wicked, which is just parallelism. So he doesn't carry a weapon. He doesn't need any other weapon than the word of his lips. Likewise, this idea appears later in the book of Isaiah, where in the servant songs of Isaiah 49, it says, he made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me into a polished arrow. In his quiver, he hid me away. And so these images of King Messiah, who strikes with the weapon of the authority of his word, come into the New Testament in this manner, where Paul, for example, says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8, then the lawless one, the Torahless one, will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will kill with the breath of his mouth, and bring to nothing by the appearance of his coming. And so when we come to the end of this revelation of Yeshua, in chapter 19, verse 15, it speaks of it this way. It says, from his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. And he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. So the sword of his mouth, the authority of his word, the weapon of his words, implies that he has an enemy. He strikes at an enemy with the authority of his word. And the enemy is Satan, the old enemy, we know that. But in this passage, we learn that the sword of King Yeshua's mouth can also be turned against those who lead his disciples astray. As it says in verse 14 of chapter 2, I have a few things against you. There are some who hold to the teaching of Balaam, some who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans, and so forth. We've already studied this. We already got it. We already got this material down a couple weeks ago when we learned about the Nicolaitans, right? So we know what he's talking about, but listen to what he says in regard to those who are being led astray and those who are leading astray. He says, therefore, repent. If not, I will come to you soon. That sounds like a good thing. Jesus is going to come to us soon. No, this is what we call a come to Jesus moment. That's right. He says, I will come to you soon and war against them with the sword of my mouth. Imagine that. Imagine our master coming against us and warring against us with the sword of his mouth. Don't want to be on the receiving edge of either edge of that sword. This is modern Bergama in Turkey today. Bergama, you can hear Pergamum in Bergama. It was a major cultic pilgrimage center for the worship of the Roman gods. It was a healing center. Impressive archaeological remains today. Really amazing. Well, that's all that's left of Pergamum today in modern Turkey is these ruins, but it's a tourist attraction because the remains are so spectacular there. But when the Apostle John saw his vision on Patmos and wrote this letter to the believers that assembled in Pergamum, this was one of the most influential cities in the Roman Empire. And one reason that it was so important, such an important city, was because of its spiritual importance as a holy city. It had three temples dedicated to the worship of the Roman emperor. One for the goddess of Athena, and there was the great altar of Zeus in Pergamum that we'll learn about tonight. Zeus, Jupiter, the king of the Greek pantheon. And the worship of the emperors and this major temple and the Athenian cult, all of this was really important, but even more important was Asclepius, the god of healing. Because if you had any sort of sickness, any sort of affliction, and your local doctor couldn't handle it, he would probably give you a referral to travel to Pergamum and the temple of Asclepius, the Asclepian, built in honor of the god of healing. You know Asclepius, the guy with the staff and the serpent wrapped around the staff? You're probably familiar with this symbol. It's now a pretty universal symbol of medical help and healing. But this was Asclepius. In the first century, the Asclepion at Pergamum became a popular hospital across between a sort of a hospital, divine oracle center, and health spa. Whatever your situation was, you could get it fixed there. So you could go there and you could have like spa treatments where you know soak in mud and put cucumbers on your eyes, or whatever people did back then. Or if you had more serious, more serious ailments, so much so the fame of this as a healing center was so great that even the Roman emperors, when they became ill, they traveled to Pergamum, to the Asclepion, to be healed. But this was, I don't like going to the doctor. I don't think anyone likes going to the doctor. Who likes going to the doctor? But this was really creepy. Like you go to the Asclepion, first thing you would do is you would travel from the city of Pergamum into the holy district of the Asclepion through this dark, creepy tunnel. Actually, it was supposed to be, so you can still go through the tunnel today. It's supposed to be relaxing to travel through the tunnel. But you come, so then when you enter in through the tunnel into this, into the Asclepion itself, you would be administered a sedative. And then you would spend the night in the dormitories there in the Asclepion, and they would release the snakes. It's true. That's what the snake's all about on the staff. So they released the snakes, and while you slept in your drug-induced slumber, the snakes would slither about. And it was a really good sign if one slithered up with you. And because, Asclepius was a serpent god. And so then as the snakes moved around, Asclepius would speak to you. He would speak to you in your dreams and give you a diagnosis and tell you what you need to do. And then you were supposed to relate this, or whatever dream you had, you were supposed to relate to the doctors in the morning, the priests there, and they would interpret what Asclepius had revealed to you. They would prescribe their treatments on the basis of the revelation you received during the night. So, and the treatment of the insane, and this is really one of the very first psychiatric wards of the ancient world there in Pergamum. So you had a lot of people making pilgrimage, and they had really low mortality rates. I was just doing a little research on this today, getting ready for teaching, and what they had they could boast a very high success rate in the Asclepion because they didn't allow terminal patients, and if anyone looked like they were going to be terminal, they were sent out of the city, so then they could keep their numbers up. I mean, it'd be like if you imagine going to the hospital and they say, oh, that looks too serious. We don't want to. They're like, you're sick. You need a doctor. You need to get out of here. Anyway, so that was part of it. That's part of Pergamum. That's what's going on in Pergamum in the days of the first century when these believers are emerging, these collection of disciples of Yeshua of Nazareth, both Jews and Gentiles who are connected with the Jewish community in the Jewish quarter there in Pergamum. And you also had the worship of Zeus, Jupiter, going on in Pergamum. In fact, it was a center for the worship of Zeus. That was the altar of Zeus in Pergamum. And this is the structure that most scholars identify as Satan's throne, as referred to in the book of Revelation. So most of that altar actually still survives today.
And surrounding it, you can see these marble friezes all the way. They go all the way around and around the back that depict the battle of the Greek gods versus the Titans. It's really an incredible, incredible relic. That's an idea that we find from the Hebrew scriptures as well, where you associate a god in his temple with the god's throne. So his temple, the location of his temple, is considered his throne. So even in, for example, in Psalm 11:4, it says, "The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven." You know, so we have this connection between a temple and a throne. And this is what our master refers to when he says to the believers, "I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is." You had a continuously rotating group of priests offering up burnt offerings, sacrifices to Zeus at this altar 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the master praises the believers in Pergamum for standing firm in the face of persecution. We already know the context for these letters and so forth. And then when challenged by the Roman authorities to deny our master's name, as we've learned, they did not. So he congratulates them for holding fast to his name. And he reminds them, in the course of this congratulation, he reminds them of a similar season of persecution, which seems to have befallen the community sometime earlier. We don't know how much earlier, but sometime earlier, because he makes these words. He says, "You hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness." And that is, of course, the Greek word from which we derive the word martyr. "My witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells." Who is Antipas? Wouldn't we like to know? I mean, it's this character that receives only this one reference, this one time, inspiring our curiosity. Yes? I sure hope so. It inspired my curiosity, so I looked him up. Turns out he's a patron saint of dentists. You get a toothache, you pray to Saint Antipas. That's what you do. According to early church tradition, if you got a toothache, you went to the tomb of Antipas in Pergamum, and you could pray at his tomb and, you know, then go see a dentist. So what's the real story? I thought, okay, that doesn't sound too credible. What's the real story behind Antipas of Pergamum? Well, according to Christian tradition, John the Apostle appointed Antipas to serve as bishop over the community of believers in Pergamum. So he was an earlier bishop of the community. Antipas is a Herodian name, very popular Herodian. It's a common name in the Roman Empire, but it's a very popular Herodian name. So I think that he's probably a Jewish believer. So we have a no longer extant document called the Martyrdom of Antipas, which we only know through retellings. And in the retellings, we find out about how the Roman governor, here at Pergamum, he convicted Antipas for some offense against the gods and had him put to death at one of the local temples. And apparently, what was going on was Antipas was healing people, even madmen. That he was exorcising spirits in the process, much like our master Yeshua did in this psychiatric hospital of the ancient world. And the legends say that the demons fled from before Antipas because he was so adept at exorcisms and healings. And the demons then appeared to the soothsayers and the priests in a dream and confessed how afraid they were of Antipas, and how because of him they had no recourse except to depart from the city. And this alarmed the priests, who relied upon this power of the spirits. This alarmed the priests, and so they turned Antipas over to the governor, made accusations to him with the Roman governor of the city. And so this began an interrogation. Now, in those days, if someone was accused of being a believer, as I've explained to you before, what happened was you would appear before a tribunal.
the governor of the city and the other judges, would cross-examine you, ask you a few questions. They'd ask you if you're a believer, if you believed in this the crucified one, Yeshua of Nazareth. And if you denied believing and being a follower of the crucified one, Yeshua of Nazareth, then they would ask you to prove that by offering a sacrifice to the Roman gods, specifically to the Caesars, to show your loyalty to Rome. You would offer some incense, pour out a drink offering. It's a very simple procedure. You're in, you're out. It's like a same day type of thing. It's not too difficult to avoid the charge of being an atheist. However, if you testified that you were, in fact, a disciple and a believer in Yeshua of Nazareth, well, since this was an illegal sect and considered an illegal religion, superstition by the Roman government, then you were considered guilty of the crime of atheism, and you could be put to death. Now, the thing is, getting put to death is never pleasant, but there are some ways of getting put to death that are more pleasant than others, or less unpleasant than others, perhaps we could say. For example, crucifixion is not a pleasant way to be put to death. Ordinarily, a crucifixion can last three days, 4 days. Those people languish on those crosses until usually what kills them is the tetanus as it sets in and the body starts to lock up and twist around on the tree. It's terrible, terrible, horrible, nasty way to die, crucifixion. The Romans were, that was one of their favorite modes. They were always creative in these sorts of things. However, if you were a Roman citizen, you couldn't be put to death by any other means except for a quick beheading. That was one of the perks of Roman citizenship. And this is why we find that Peter was crucified, whereas Paul was beheaded, because Peter did not have citizenship, Paul did. It looks to me like Antipas was not a Roman citizen. After his interrogation, Antipas testified during the interrogation that he was indeed a disciple of Yeshua of Nazareth. He testified, he said he was a faithful witness, and as we have learned, the word witness is the same as the Greek behind the word martyr. And so he became a martyr because of his testimony. According to the legend, Antipas faced his accusers and he said, "When your so-called gods, lords of the universe, are frightened of me, a mere mortal man, so frightened that they must flee from this city, shouldn't you recognize by this that your faith in them is a false one?" So they took him to put him to death in the courtyard of one of the temples. The original version that I read said the Temple of Artemis. There could have been a Temple of Artemis there. We don't know. I've read others that said it was at the Temple of Zeus. It doesn't matter. Here's what they did. They put him inside a bronze oven that was fashioned in the shape of a bull. It's a really strange idea. Some sources indicate that this strange cultic object, an oven shaped, fashioned in the shape of a bull, a bronze, a hollow on the inside, you know, big bronze statue, hollow on the inside that you would heat from below. Some sources indicate that this was used in connection with exorcisms. I have another idea. I think that perhaps if such an object existed, that it might have been used simply to cook the meats from sacrifices offered to the gods. That seems more likely to me, that you would, after you would sacrifice a bull, you'd take the meat of the bull, load it up in the bronze oven, fire up the bronze oven, and then cook the meat in there. But I don't know. I was just guessing. I was completely speculating because this is such a bizarre idea of having a hollow bronze bull that you heat from beneath. So apparently, here's another explanation. So they load him in there, they load him into this bronze oven. And another explanation I read said that the idea was, as you heat this bronze bull, the person starts to cry out, and it makes it sound like, as the sound comes out of the bronze bull, it sounds like the bull is alive and making cow noises. I don't know. That just does... I don't understand it. It's a bizarre, bizarre idea. But there you go. Church tradition fixes this terrible, strange martyrdom of Antipas at 92 Common Era. It could be, I don't know. The point is, the death of Antipas must have happened earlier than the reign of Domitian, earlier in the reign of Domitian, or perhaps even back in the days of Nero. But the master referred to it as an event that happened in the past. It seems like it was a fixed event in the minds of the believers of Pergamum. So he reminds them of how they stood fast for his name in that earlier time of persecution, in the days of Antipas. And so he encourages them to stand fast in the future. And this is the reason for martyr stories in the first place. That we should be reminded of those who stood fast in the past, and then we should draw encouragement from those stories to stand fast in the future ourselves. That's the story of Antipas. That's what I learned in studying the story of Antipas. But what about this throne of Satan? If you go to Pergamum today and go to see the throne of Satan, you'll only find the foundation of it, the base, where this altar of Zeus used to stand. It's gone. It doesn't exist anymore because it was carted off to Europe, reassembled, as you see here, in Berlin in 1930, shortly before the Nazis fired up the ovens and started shoving Jews into them.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.